Welcome to another episode of Out the Rabbit Hole here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Robert Larson. This is our November 11th, 2010 edition of the show. It's 4:06 p.m. on the clock here in Irvine, California. Before we get fully underway, I have a couple of quick reminders for you. First of all, the opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the KUCI staff or management or the UC Board of Regents. And if you want to give me some feedback on the show, I always appreciate that. You can email me at rglarson@kuci.org. You can also catch me on Facebook. That's facebook.com/rglarson. Why are Americans so likely to believe often fantastical conspiracy theories about their government when all the available facts don't necessarily indicate that? Other than semi-obvious psychological reasons is the eagerness to believe based on the fact that the government promulgates its own conspiracy theories and has been caught in actual criminal conspiracies. An interesting examination of this is found in a recent book called Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. Our special guest today is the author, Catherine Olmsted. She is a professor of history at UC Davis and has also written Challenging the Secret Government, the Post-Watergate Investigations of the CIA and FBI, and Red Spy Queen, a biography of Elizabeth Bentley. Catherine Olmsted, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. What inspired you to write this particular book? Was this an outgrowth of observations arising from your previous books?
Yes, actually it was. My first book was on, as you mentioned, the Church Committee investigations into the CIA and FBI after Watergate. And the book came out in 1996, and it was with an academic press that wasn't necessarily that well promoted, yet I got a lot of correspondence from people around the country who really were engaged with the subject of investigations of the CIA and FBI, in particular with CIA conspiracies. And so I started getting a lot of phone calls and letters from people who were convinced that they saw themselves in the Church Committee reports and that they themselves had been victims of CIA conspiracies. And sometimes some of them had, you know, quite elaborate detailed stories about how they believed they had been, for example, victims of CIA drug testing experiments. And what I became fascinated by was how hard it was to tell whether they were clinically paranoid or whether actually there was something to their story, because the CIA had carried out these real conspiracies. It had, for example, tested LSD on random Americans in the 1950s and 1960s. And so I became interested in this line between conspiracy theories and real conspiracies, and how government conspiracies contribute to conspiracy theories among the public, because people say, well, here it's been documented that the government did these real criminal things, so who's to say what else they've been doing that they haven't told us yet?
So kind of what I get from your book is that there were these real heinous acts often that the government committed, such as the CIA drug experiments. There were we were lied to. There was a big conspiracy with Iran-Contra, that kind of thing. We know about that. People were actually convicted of aspects of that. So that stuff really happened. Those are real conspiracies. And because of that, people therefore are highly suspicious and then kind of go to a conspiracy theory as kind of default. Every time they hear something that's a little bit odd, a little bit weird, the facts they have don't necessarily all explain everything. Well, it's got to be this. It's got to be the CIA doing this. It's got to be some sort of secret team. It's got to be, maybe it's some really big crazy conspiracy, the New World Order or something like that. And so that many of these things are not true. There's no facts to really back them up. There's maybe some weird speculation. But because the government has done these things that we do know about, people are more likely to believe.
Yes, I think that's very true. And you mentioned in your intro there that also sometimes government officials promote conspiracy theories. So they promote a way of looking at the world, in other words, that can then be turned against them. For example, with the Bush administration implying or even stating that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that he might be sharing with Al-Qaeda. And so, therefore, there was a conspiracy between Iraq and terrorists, global terrorists, that justified an invasion of Iraq. So this is a conspiracy theory that government officials are setting forth. And when the weapons of mass destruction were not found, then a number of Americans said, well, clearly there was a conspiracy for 9/11. It's just not the one that the government has been promoting. There must be an alternative. And so that's the point at which a much larger number of Americans begin to believe that the U.S. government itself was involved in the 9/11 attacks.
Right. There were the 9/11 conspiracy theories before the Iraq War. I mean, these things were around, I think, as early as the 2002, or, you know, within a year, I think, of the 9/11 attack. So, but yeah, it was kind of a really small number of people that entertained these 9/11 conspiracy theories that inside job, our government was involved, or at least looked the other way. And then, yeah, as you state, after we saw that the government did engage in this conspiracy of putting together bogus information to make the case for invading Iraq, then more people were like, wait a minute, well, maybe they made 9/11 happen. They seemed so intent on going to war.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So I'd like to get into 9/11 a little bit more as we go along, but I kind of want to go a little bit kind of chronologically.
Okay.
Let's, you know, with your book, you start at World War One, and what was going on there? What is the conspiracy theory there, and what actions of the government actually fueled that?
Well, I started my book with World War One because that's really when you get the birth of the modern state in the United States, and also the birth of the surveillance state, because it's in World War One that the U.S. government first gets the power to have a really massive and effective draft. In other words, to conscript ordinary Americans and force them to go fight overseas. And this is quite astonishing for people who hadn't had that sort of tradition in their lives, that the government, some people start suing the government saying that it's unconstitutional, the draft, because it is slavery, and it therefore violates the 13th Amendment against slavery. So it's really shocking to people that the government now has the power to draft millions of its citizens, to raise this army and deploy it overseas, to take over factories, commandeer them for war production, to even start daylight saving time, to save energy for the war effort. And so there's all of these new powers by the government. There's also the Espionage and Sedition Acts, which effectively criminalize dissent against the war, making it illegal to at first publish and then speak out against the war in a way that could damage the morale of the troops. So there's this new state, and there's a Bureau of Investigation that becomes the Federal Bureau of Investigation that's enforcing these laws, that's investigating Americans, that's spying on Americans. And so Americans, many of them, start getting the idea that the government is spying on them, because it is. And so they start having conspiracy theories about the government. And one of the most prominent among leftists who are opposed first to the U.S. intervention in the war and then to the U.S. attempt to overthrow the new Soviet government in 1919 is that corporate interests have secretly taken over the U.S. government and are tricking the American people into joining these wars that Americans fundamentally would not support if they had a truly democratic society. And so there's conspiracy theories during the war that Colonel Edward House who's one of Woodrow Wilson's advisors, has manipulated him into joining the Allied war effort. And then there's conspiracy theories that are very popular in the 1930s, as Americans look back on the First World War, that arms manufacturers and bankers had secret influences in the White House and manipulated the United States into joining the First World War, which by the 1930s most Americans think was a huge mistake. So in other words, they're looking for villains. It's not just systemic issues. It's not about empire. It's not about the Germans sinking our ships. It's about these villains in the banking and manufacturing community who tricked the United States into joining the war.
And so, to me, okay, to say that they tricked them and there was a conspiracy, you know, I don't necessarily say that's true, but when I look at things up to today, and we mentioned the Iraq War, is it not unreasonable to think that these certain corporate entities, especially people like the, you know, arms manufacturers, that they do have a vested interest in going to war, and though they may not lie or manufacture information or engage in some vast criminal conspiracy, may use their influence to nudge things in a certain way. Is that paranoid to think that?
Well, no, I don't think that's paranoid to think that, but that's sort of, it's a little bit different to say there's a military-industrial complex in the United States and that there has been in some way or another since the 1910s, and that this military-industrial complex has an interest in the United States joining wars, and that this creates certain structural imperatives for war. That's different than saying, you know, there was this evil guy who had access to the president, who convinced him to do something that was inimical to the interests of the country, or that there were this couple of guys on the Federal Reserve Board who manipulated exchange rates to make it to their financial interest to enter the war. I mean, you see what I'm saying? Is there's this systemic concerns, and then there's demonizing one or two individuals.
For which you don't have actual proof. You're just basically speculating, and that person has never been charged or brought into court or any of that kind of
right thing.
So, right, okay. So, yeah, we've discussed different conspiracy theories on this show, but I try to approach them agnostically. You know, we don't have all the facts. Let's entertain this notion without falling into belief. Now, that's how I like to look at it. But I think that, you know, and I think that's reasonable in light of these known and accepted conspiracies. And but, you know, I juxtapose that to those who are professional conspiracy theorists, or as you refer to some people, conspiracists, and these people who often see everything as a conspiracy. That's their default mode, and it's usually a really big one. And you talk about some of these in the book, and you know, there's the international bankers conspiracy, you know, that usually is kind of a little bit of a cover for an anti-Jewish sort of conspiracy theory. Then you have sometimes it's the Catholics, and sometimes it's you know, the more popular one we see here a lot nowadays is the New World Order, and some of these other ones. And I think of people, I mean, you're probably familiar with, like Alex Jones, and if you ever listen to his show, it's every day, it's conspiracy theory nonstop. And then that's, I think, a lot of things are being put out there that just encourage people to live in a more fearful state and to always distrust. And, you know, I prefer a middle ground. You look at these things, sometimes there are conspiracies, but to not put it out there that we know there's a conspiracy when, in fact, we don't. And is that a reasonable place to be, do you think?
Yes, I mean, I think it's really, it can be very hard to be a citizen of a democracy because you are called upon to keep, to hold your leaders to account and to be informed about the actions of your government. So you need to keep informed, and you need to question, and you need to challenge. But the problem with some conspiracy theorists is that they go beyond this sort of healthy questioning of democratic officials and instead begin to believe that the government has no legitimacy at all, that they're all government officials are all a bunch of crooks and liars, or they're all involved in one massive plot against the people. And this causes citizens to become very alienated from their government, and it leads to an ideology that is so anti-government that it makes it very difficult for society to solve any problems collectively.
Yeah, so it's my perspective, and I think you would probably agree with this, is that the government, we are the government. That's what it's supposed to be. We are a democracy. We elect some of ourselves to be in that government, and we have a say in that. We vote, and the to think that it's like us versus them, it is not. It is a really paranoid viewpoint. And I see a little bit of that in the Tea Party movement that's, you know, really prominent in this election we just had, and other groups certainly on the left as well, as you point out in the book. And often the sort of far left and far right kind of meet up in this similar sort of paranoid place. And you talked about the case of Gary Webb, the San Jose Mercury News reporter who reported on the CIA in the 1980s and the crack cocaine epidemic, and that he did not actually say that the CIA was bringing cocaine into the country, but that more that they were looking the other way as their Contra allies were sort of doing that. And but then these really kind of crazier conspiracy theories built up around that, and you saw, you point out very clearly in the book how people from the far left and the far right sort of met up and was really strange bedfellows. Could you talk about that a little?
Right. Gary Webb was looking at an issue that was fairly historical for a newspaper reporter, and that he was looking in the 1990s, back in the 1980s, and he had come across some evidence in some court cases that showed that the CIA, that CIA officers had apparently known that some of their CIA agents, in other words, Nicaraguans who were not full-time U.S. government employees but paid by the U.S. government, that these CIA agents in Nicaragua were funneling cocaine into the United States and using the profits for their revolution against the communist government of Nicaragua. And because this suited the foreign policy goals of the Reagan administration, some CIA officers, you know, sort of turned a blind eye to it, looked the other way. And he was never able to document how extensive this was and how far up in the CIA hierarchy this sort of policy was approved. And he was fairly careful about making it clear that he wasn't talking about the CIA as an institution selling drugs in American cities in order to raise money, but that there were individuals in the CIA who knew that the people it supported were drug smugglers and were smuggling their drugs into the United States. So he himself was very clear about exactly what he was able to document. But that story was one of the first big stories of the Internet age, and it was picked up and read all over the world by people who then read the story and made a leap from there, which was not just that there were some individuals in the CIA who turned a blind eye to drug smuggling, but that the CIA raises its money by getting African-Americans in ghettos hooked on crack.
Mm-hmm.
And this became a very powerful urban legend, essentially, in the African American community by the late 1990s. And this conspiracy theory seemed very possible to a lot of African Americans, because the U.S. government has, of course, conducted a lot of conspiracies against the African American community, and you can see slavery as a conspiracy. But more recently, the Tuskegee experiment, where African American men were not allowed treatment for syphilis, so that the U.S. government could study what syphilis did to their bodies. So with that background, a lot of African Americans heard about Gary Webb's story about the Santa Jose Mercury News and really came to very outlandish conclusions about the CIA's role in American cities. And part of the interesting story is the way the mainstream press reacted to Gary Webb, because the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post and the New York Times then all acted as if he himself had propagated this conspiracy theory that the CIA was smuggling drugs, the CIA as an institution was smuggling drugs into American cities, and sort of set up and knocked down this straw man, which then reinforced the idea among a lot of conspiracy theorists that the media is part of the whole conspiracy against the American people.
Yeah, and I think the big papers, the New York Times, the LA Times, from what I could gather, the research I've done on this, is that it was a little bit of jealousy involved, that, you know, little old San Jose Mercury News had kind of beat them on this story, and it was kind of why they didn't want to support it and kind of wanted to push the idea that Gary Webb had been pushing the more outlandish conspiracy theory, and then his editors at the paper didn't stand up for him, and he eventually they demoted him, and then I believe he eventually quit after that and became very depressed over sort of losing his career and committed suicide. It's a pretty tragic story. Would you disagree with any of that?
No, that's a very good characterization of it. His editors immediately became very alarmed that, they didn't like being criticized by the New York Times and the LA Times and the Washington Post, so they assumed their reporter must have been wrong, even though it was clear that what he had printed was true. It was just the way it had been interpreted that was a little bit slanted. So they backed away from him, and he felt very betrayed.
And it was even one, if I have this correct, it was even one of the editors who had come up with a more titillating headline that was not Gary Webb's idea, that actually stretched the story a little bit. And so he was, really put in a bad position, and it is a sad situation. So this is Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI in Irvine. Robert Larson here speaking with Catherine Olmsted, and she is a professor of history at UC Davis, and we're talking about her book, Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. So we talk about there was the Church Committee, and there was the Iran-Contra special prosecution, and all these different things where these sort of intelligence establishment is caught doing these things. And we have these assassinations that the CIA was involved with in the 60s. There was the MKUltra and Iran-Contra, all these things. So I kind of don't feel really comfortable, even though that we've caught them on all these things, that therefore, we've cleaned it all up. We've cleaned up all the elements who are rogue in the intelligence establishment, or who are just entrenched careerists who kind of don't have the same interest that common citizens have. I feel that it's very reasonable to think that some of that is still there. So I think it's when we hear about something going on and we think, maybe this is another one of the CIA dirty tricks, I have a problem when people are just really paranoid and they always go to that. But I think it should be something that is considered every time something like this comes up. Let's at least look at that. Do you disagree with that?
No, I think it's exactly the all of the documented evidence of real conspiracies by the government is what gives anyone pause when they hear about some alleged CIA conspiracy. It's hard to dismiss anything out of hand, but what you have to do is try and find evidence and not just spread theories without knowing what you're talking about.
Right, I agree with that. Let's go on to the JFK assassination. That is probably the biggest one. So you seem to put that conspiracy theory around that in the category of the more fantastical. The Warren Commission lone nut killer conclusion you sort of defend. I find some of that a little problematic. Could we go into some of that?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay, so one of the things was you mentioned the Warren Commission members, and you listed Alan Dulles as former CIA director. You didn't mention, though, that Dulles was fired by Kennedy and that they blamed each other for the failure of the Bay of Pigs. So isn't the commission a little tainted by Dulles' inclusion?
Oh, the commission was tainted in a lot of different ways. Well, among other things, Gerald Ford was on the commission, and he was leaking all the information to the FBI as it went along. So I don't want to defend the Warren Commission at all. I think that it clearly did not do a very good job, and it was prevented from doing a very good job because most of the members were kept from learning about the most important information, and in my view, and that was that Kennedy was trying to kill Castro at the same time that he was killed by a Castro supporter. So all kinds of possible lines of evidence were not pursued because the U.S. government wanted to keep secret the fact that it was trying to kill a foreign leader at the same time that its president was killed. And so I think there's all kinds of, there are many unanswered questions in the Kennedy assassination, and they were deliberately not answered by the Warren Commission. Most of the members didn't know about a lot of key evidence, and the ones who did, like Alan Dulles, deliberately kept it secret. So the Warren Commission did a terrible job, and I think it's clear that it was a whitewash, but that doesn't mean that the conclusion that it came to was necessarily the wrong one.
Okay, so you do find that the conclusion Oswald acted alone is credible.
Well, at this point, I think it's the most, of all of the theories that are out there, if you put forward some counterfactual ones, none of them match the evidence as well as the official story. However, of all the conspiracy theories I looked at, certainly that would be the one that I would be least surprised if it turns out that there was a real conspiracy, not just a conspiracy theory. But what I find fascinating about the Kennedy assassination is that Lyndon Johnson himself was a conspiracy theorist. He thought that Castro did it, there's no evidence that Castro did it, but certainly it's interesting that the president thought that Castro did it. And yet, even though he himself was a conspiracy theorist, Johnson set out from the beginning to make sure that the commission he appointed found that there was no conspiracy because he worried that any kind of real investigation might lead to information that Cuba or the Soviet Union was somehow involved, and that this could then force him to invade Cuba or to start a nuclear war. And in any event, you would get to nuclear Armageddon within minutes, and the world would be destroyed. And so he really actually didn't care that much who killed Kennedy. I mean, as far as he was concerned, it turned out well because he was president. So for a whole host of reasons, he just decided it was better not to know. So he made sure that the investigation was not a real investigation.
Go ahead.
It's just what I'm suggesting is, though, even though they set out from the beginning to make sure to, you know, to frame Oswald essentially as the murderer doesn't mean that they weren't framing a guilty man.
So it seems to me that if any of these alternative theories are viable, that the people in charge, Johnson and many of the people on the Warren Commission, the CIA and the FBI and all these people, really had a vested interest in saying that it was Oswald and Oswald acted alone. Because if you look at the different conspiracy theories, if it was the Mafia, if the Mafia was involved, then it would sort of come out how much the CIA had been working with the Mafia. That wouldn't be good. If it came out that it was a right-wing conspiracy, many of these people in government had connections with those people, even if they may not have been involved themselves. So, and that would look embarrassing. If it was, as you said, somehow connected with the Soviet Union or Cuba, Johnson would be forced to act militarily, and that could be a total disaster. So, I think if any of those things are true, there would be an interest in not letting it out. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think that's definitely fair to say. And I think that there were all kinds of interests who wanted to make sure that that it was Oswald and that Oswald acted alone. But I also think that, you know, his wife Marina's testimony was very compelling, and nobody's been able to actually prove how she might have been part of a conspiracy, in that she indicated he was both crazy and highly politicized and a real defender of Castro, and that he had tried to kill other political figures in the past, and that he might well have decided that because Kennedy was trying to kill Castro, that he would kill Kennedy first to make sure to save Castro. So in other words, that it was a political act, that it was a highly political assassination rather than just some lone crazy guy.
You mentioned that Oswald was a known communist, and I think that's probably true. And he did have a lot of these connections with a lot of extreme right-wing groups, people that were just in his circle. And you mentioned that Oswald befriended a mysterious Russian baron, who I believe you're talking about is George de Morenchil. But it seems to me that he was more than just a friend, and that there was some, he had kind of helped Oswald out a lot and was kind of sort of squiring him around, and the whole Dallas scene there. And de Morenchil was connected with a lot of these Dallas, this kind of like right wing slash intelligence slash oil interests. And I don't know, I think that's a bit suspicious.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that are suspicious. What it's hard to do, though, if you're coming up with a counterfactual, is how does Oswald get that job in the book depository? How does the motorcade come to pass right by it? You know, how do people in the CIA, if that's who it is, or in the Soviet Union, or in the, you know, oil companies, or in the Secret Service, whoever, how do they arrange all of that? And that's where nobody's ever been able to really, you know, nail down any sort of evidence for anything except randomness, you know, just chance.
Yeah, was a lot of things that had to really come together by random chance for things to have turned out like they did.
Yeah, but it also were a lot of things that would have had to have been planned by a lot of people to, you know, get him there in the book depository at the right time. You know, because he had just started that job, and also get the motorcade to pass by there.
Isn't it also a little weird that Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, and then he just sort of comes back into the U.S. with virtually no problem?
I mean, it's totally weird. Well, first of all, it's really weird that they let him in, because they didn't want to, according to his Soviet file. You know, the Soviets rejected him, and then they changed their mind, and then ultimately he changed his mind, and the United States let him back in. So, you know, both the Soviet and the American governments acted very odd in both cases. The documentary record in both cases is that the government in each case was just embarrassed, that the Soviets thought it was embarrassing. He had tried to kill himself, and to have him go back to the United States and say, I wanted to be a Soviet communist, but they wouldn't let me in, and so I tried to kill myself, that this would be an embarrassing story, and it was just easier to keep him. And that the American government conversely thought that it would be a propaganda coup to say this guy thought he was a communist, but actually he wants to come back to the United States. So that's what the documents show. You know, again, who knows if they were, if those are faked documents, but that's the only evidence that exists at the moment.
But in the intelligence circles, when people are working deep cover, they do that. They create false documents, and there are all these characters, again, that Oswald had contact with, that had contact with American intelligence, and so I don't think it's too bizarre to suspect that. I mean, we cannot prove that, but I don't think it's too bizarre to suspect that. And because, as you said, the Warren Commission was tainted, I think we're still going to be talking about this for a long time, and I know many of the conspiracy theories out there about this are a little crazy, but I think it's we may find some things out as decades go by that will surprise us in that regard.
Well, that could be. I'm still a little skeptical about why. You know, that Kennedy would have been that hated by, say, the CIA, that they would want to kill him.
Well, yeah, we don't know everything that goes on behind the scenes, and we do know that he was pretty angry about Bay of Pigs. He felt he had been betrayed, that they had given him wrong intelligence, and they were pretty angry with him when he didn't up the ante when it went awry and he didn't order in an escalation. And the mafia was very upset about that and wanted to get back into Cuba and get what they felt was rightfully theirs. So it doesn't seem that wild to me. You know, I agree with you that all the particulars, there's a lot that would have had to been brought together to make that work. But, you know, I'm still agnostic about it. So, but yeah, very, very interesting. This is Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI in Irvine. I'm Robert Larson speaking with Catherine Olmsted, and we're talking about her book, Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. And so, yeah, let's move on to 9/11. That, I think in some ways that may have eclipsed JFK as the big conspiracy theory. What do you think? Is JFK still bigger?
Well, in terms of, you know, the polls, when people are asked specific questions, JFK, there's still a larger number of Americans who think there was a conspiracy. But as JFK recedes into the past, there's fewer and fewer people who really know much about it or care much about it. So in that sense, I think it is being eclipsed by 9/11, certainly for young people, you know, for the students in my classes here at UCD, for example. They don't much care about JFK anymore, but they sure do care about 9/11.
Yeah, and just a little quick trip around the internet, just put in 9/11 and Building 7 or whatever, all these things you can just put into Google, and it just comes up like crazy, and you mentioned that in the book. And so, okay, so 9/11, what are some things that the government did or didn't do that made people suspicious?
Well, I'd argue that the biggest thing they did to make people suspicious would be their creation of this conspiracy theory that about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which they used to justify the invasion of Iraq, which then made many Americans question whether they were telling the truth about anything at all, and whether 9/11 had been some sort of elaborate pretext for war. Some sort of what people in the conspiracy theory community call a false flag operation, where the government claims that it's been attacked by another group or another country, but in fact it's its own people. So I think that the Bush administration's general deceptiveness about the Iraq war is what really made the 9/11 theories take off.
Right, because that was like right in our faces. I mean, when they were trying to go to war in Iraq, there were people at the time who were saying, and people not just internet researchers sitting at home in their basement, but people who had been in the intelligence community who had worked, say, in the Reagan administration or, you know, previous administrations, and who are saying, wait a minute, this is not credible, this whole thing, Saddam's al-Qaeda connection, Saddam still having a nuclear program and all this, it's not credible. And there were people, Scott Ritter, who had been a weapons inspector. No, and they were just, the mainstream media were just blowing him off, and there was this march to war. And so we saw that, and then as time went by, it more and more truth came out, and they misled us into this war. And by 2006, Bush's and Cheney's approval ratings were so low because of this and other things that people were just willing to not trust them on anything. And, you know, the 9/11 conspiracy theories really took off. So I think some other things I could bring up that I thought built people's suspicions, and just want to get your commentary on that. If 9/11 was a horrible intelligence failure, why wasn't anybody of any prominence fired?
Well, exactly, because they didn't want to, because the Bush administration didn't want to take responsibility for it. If you fire people, then it shows that you made a mistake, right? So they weren't willing to fire anybody. In fact, they promoted people. They gave them, you know, Medal of Freedom to them. So this caused a lot of people to think it was some sort of conspiracy. I think it's just incompetence and attempting to cover up incompetence, but certainly you could read that sort of evidence as conspiracy.
Right. So I think you're actually saying that with 9/11 and JFK, that the 9/11 Commission and the Warren Commission, if they were doing any covering up or any investigation surrounded both of those events, it was covering up incompetence more so than covering up an inside job, the government actually being involved in the criminality of it all. And you mentioned that J. Edgar Hoover was really concerned that, wow, this was on my watch that Kennedy was killed. We need to, you know, stop the bleeding as far as us looking bad. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, I would say the Warren Commission is even a bigger cover-up than that, because they didn't just want to cover up incompetence. They wanted to cover up the Castro plots, the fact that the U.S. government was consorting with the mafia to kill Castro and all of these, you know, lunatic ways. And so they didn't want that to come out, and in part because it would have ruined the American image and it would have hurt the Democratic Party, but it also, you know, in Johnson's defense, he really thought it could lead to the deaths of tens of millions of people. So for all of those reasons, he didn't want that information to come out. So the Warren Commission really had big stakes, high stakes. I think the 9/11 Commission, it was more a matter of incompetence.
Yeah, and could you talk about 9/11 Commissioner Zelikow and his sort of conflict of interest?
Well, he was a staff director, so he was in charge of the large staff of the commission and sort of crafting the investigations, what questions would be asked, what questions wouldn't be asked. I mean, he had a lot of power that way. And some of the 9/11 family members who had pushed for a commission were very disappointed with the way he was directing the investigation, and they felt he was compromised by the fact that he was good friends with Condoleezza Rice, and that he had co-authored a book with her, and that he had been part of the transition team for the National Security Council from the Clinton to the Bush administration. So they felt that he was not interested in finding any information that would hurt the Bush administration, any kind of evidence of conspiracy or incompetence. And so they felt that the investigation was a whitewash because of his role. And they weren't, a lot of the family members, at least initially, did not believe that the U.S. government was involved in a conspiracy on 9/11, but they thought that there might be some sort of conspiracy extending to U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, and that, like the Warren Commission, the 9/11 Commission was deliberately not interested in following any trails of evidence that might lead to conclusions that no one in the U.S. government wanted to hear. In other words, that there were elements of the Saudi or Pakistani government that were behind the 9/11 attacks.
Well, yeah, there are some pretty bizarre leads going back to the Pakistani ISI, their version of CIA, and some things that they knew, and I don't think were fully followed up on by the 9/11 Commission. Yeah, and also Saudi Arabia mentioned the ties with the Bush family has with the Saudi government are a little troubling, and some of the things the Saudi government may have done as far as looking the other way is, at the very least, could have been very embarrassing if all the details of that had come out. Very embarrassing for the Bush family. And it was George W. Bush was involved in some kind of business deal with one of bin Laden's brothers. And there's also the issue of the Afghanistan war back in the 70s, 80s, and our support of the Mujahideen and that the Al-Qaeda connections with all of that. And, I mean, that's kind of out there in the open that we were involved in all that. I mean, it doesn't prove that, oh, therefore we knew what these guys were doing up to 9/11. But if all the details about that come out, it could be very embarrassing. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And, you know, there was a U.S. Senate investigation for a few weeks when the Democrats controlled the Senate in the summer of 2002. And Bob Graham of Florida was the Senate Intelligence Committee chair. And he was very much a believer that there had to be more investigation done on the hijackers who were in the United States, particularly who were in San Diego, and how they were being financed, and whether the Saudi government was actually helping them, and whether the Saudi government, therefore, was involved in the 9/11 attacks. And so there were real mainstream political figures who believed that there was some sort of wider conspiracy that were very angry that these leads were not pursued. And so I think a lot of that anger and frustration and curiosity and suspicion is behind the 9/11 theories. And so there's a whole universe of 9/11 theories. There are the ones, you know, propagated by, say, Senator Graham, that, you know, we don't really know the full extent of the Saudi intelligence services' role in financing the hijackers, you know, a very kind of narrowly constructed but intriguing and possibly true conspiracy theory to, you know, the much more outlandish ones that essentially have Dick Cheney piloting the planes.
Right, yeah, and they get a little bit crazy, and yeah. Well, I wish we had more time. There's so many more questions I'd like to ask you about all of this, and yeah, the book Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories in American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. Catherine Olmsted, what does the government need to do to earn our trust and to stop conspiracism as the first-choice explanation of things?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I'm getting a lot more discouraged now than I was just even a couple years ago. Because in theory, what the government needs to do is be more transparent. And the Obama administration did make some gestures in that direction when it came into office and issued some directives that are supposed to make documents much more easily available. There's more people declassifying documents. There's supposed to be a presumption of disclosure rather than a presumption of secrecy by the people who are classifying the documents. So, you know, in theory, things have gotten better in the last couple of years, but of course, in reality, there's still a lot of secrecy, and the Obama administration is continuing a lot of the secret foreign policies of the Bush administration. And there's just, in general, a lot of distrust of government that's been there since the 1970s that isn't going away no matter who's the president. So it is a very difficult situation for any administration to restore trust. And clearly, President Obama's attempts to at least rhetorically endorse transparency have not stopped people from coming up with all sorts of outlandish conspiracy theories about him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And so do we need more reform of our intelligence community? Do we need more checks and balances on the CIA, FBI, defense intelligence, Homeland Security? Do we need more checks and balances? Is that possible?
Well, in today's political climate, it doesn't look possible, but certainly in an ideal world, I'd say yes. I'd say that, we need to have an intelligence agency, but we also need to make sure it's overseen and that there is democratic accountability, that the oversight committees in Congress, which are the best alternative because they are democratically elected officials, would actually hold the CIA accountable.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's hope some of that comes into play. Really want to thank you for being with us today, Catherine Olmsted. This is really intriguing work. I'm glad to have read this, and it's opened my mind a bit to looking at things a little differently. And, so Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11, Catherine Olmsted, Professor of History at UC Davis. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Okay, bye now. All right, yes, that book, Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11, subtitle, main title, Real Enemies. So, all right, we're just about out of time here. You want to be staying tuned to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, or if you're listening on the web, www.kuci.org, because we've got more great programming coming up. Matt Kaplan will be here to present to you Counterspin and Planetary Radio. And I'll remind you once more, the opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the KUCI staff or management or the UC Board of Regents. And if you want to give me some feedback on the show, I always appreciate that. You can email me at rglarson@kuci.org. You can also catch me on Facebook. That's facebook.com/rglarson. Robert Larson saying I'll be talking to you next week.